KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Coming up, we'll hear the latest on the North Bay fires.
Emergency crews were dispatched to respond to at least 10 locations where there were downed arcing power lines and exploding transformers.
Then we hear a poet's recounting of his border crossing through the Sonoran Desert.
I am not the only 9-year-old who has slipped my backpack under the rancher's fences. I'm still in that van that picked us up from Devil's Highway.
And we'll talk about the accessibility of poetry. Do certain genres have a bad rap?
There's a kind of poetry angst out there, and people see a poem, they're like, oh, I'm just not going to understand that poem.
Seeking understanding today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Wildfires tearing through California wine country have flared up again, destroying hundreds more buildings and leading to new evacuation orders. Authorities raised the death toll to 21 and warned that the number would rise. At least 3,500 homes and businesses have been destroyed since the wildfires started Sunday, making them the third deadliest and most destructive blazes in state history. CAL FIRE is looking into whether reports of power lines falling down and electrical transformers exploding may have led to the disaster. The East Bay Times carried a story about PG&E's potential culpability. It was written by Paul Rogers, science editor at KQED and environment writer at the San Jose Mercury News. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney.
So tell me about this article in the East Bay Times. What did you find?
Well, we analyzed the dispatch records from Sonoma County on Sunday night when the fire began, and the first report came in around 9:22 p.m. around Santa Rosa. And what we found is over the next 90 minutes, emergency crews were dispatched to respond to at least 10 locations where there were downed arcing power lines and exploding transformers.
And so this is something that PG&E has had an issue with in the past. You go on to talk about in that story, and high winds can obviously topple power lines.
Yeah, this is a fairly common way that fires start in California. PG&E has had problems over the years and has been found liable because they didn't maintain their power lines properly. They've been the cause of other fires around the state. So have other big utilities in San Diego and elsewhere. The most recent one was in 2015. PG&E was found to have caused the Butte Fire up in Amador County, which burned more than 70,000 acres, burned more than 500 homes, and killed two people. They were fined $8.3 million by the PUC in that case. They were sent a bill for $90 million from CAL FIRE to respond, you know, to cover the costs of fighting that fire. And there are more than 1,000 lawsuits, as I recall, still pending, seeking hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in damages.
What is the resolution that ends up coming out of these cases? Has PG&E paid off a lot of fines? Have they changed their practices?
Yeah, usually what happens in a case like this is the utility, after the investigation is done, the utility will argue that it wasn't entirely their fault or there were other conditions or acts of God because it was really windy. And they may not have to pay 100% of all the costs, either through a court proceeding or through a penalty from the PUC. They may be found to be partially responsible, for example. And, you know, basically there are state laws that set limits for utilities. They have to cut trees back in certain distances from power lines. The stronger the voltage is, the further away you have to go from the line. And it's unclear here, and we really have to be careful on this. The fire investigators have not yet in these fires settled on the cause of the fire, but this is one of the things they're certainly looking at.
CAL FIRE has said that they think that PG&E power lines might have caused it at this point. Do you know how long an investigation like this takes in order to find real culpability?
The length of investigations varies, but it could certainly take months before they find out because, you know, they on something where hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake, where many people have died, the fire investigators from CAL FIRE want to get it right. And if it looks like the utility was to blame in some part, or this is how it started, then the PUC also will open an investigation. But, you know, what we found in our reporting yesterday was that already people who have been attorneys in other cases involving power lines that caused fires are already being contacted by property owners and victims of these fires.
And final question. Obviously, there are power lines all over the Bay Area, particularly in heavily populated areas. Is there anything that people can do or should do to watch out for potential problems? Because obviously, we have to have a lot of trust in the power companies that are maintaining these lines.
Yeah, what's difficult here is that there are more than 100,000 miles of power lines in PG&E's service area, which runs from Oregon to Bakersfield. And so, you know, it's a very difficult job. But if you're concerned and you see a tree on your street that's up into the power lines or branches leaning over the power lines, something like that, you should certainly call PG&E. You should let them know about it. You should ask them to come deal with it. You know, almost like if you would smell gas or have a concern about a gas line in your neighborhood, because both can be very dangerous. You know, and in terms of the investigation, I think when you look at the possible causes of a fire like this that happened in the middle of the night, with about 10 fires all starting at the same time in the same general location, logically, there are only a few things that could have caused that. One would be lightning. There's no evidence that there were a lot of lightning strikes that night. The second one would be arson. That's still certainly a possibility. And the third would be high winds that knock down power lines. And as PG&E has already said, there were very high winds there, in some places up to 75 miles an hour. And those winds did affect some of their lines. The question now is, specifically, what happened, when, where did the fire start precisely, and did PG&E follow the rules in maintaining those lines?
That's Paul Rogers, co-author of the story PG&E Power Lines Linked to Wine Country Fires in the East Bay Times. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find that story and other reporting on the fire at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. At age 9, Javier Zamora left his grandparents' home in El Salvador and made the treacherous journey across the U.S.-Mexico border by himself. He was looking to reunite with his parents. When he was little, they left El Salvador, fleeing the civil war that resulted in the deaths of 75,000 Salvadorans. It was a war that the U.S. was involved in. They helped arm and fund the right-wing military. After multiple attempts, Zamora successfully crossed the border. Now he's an accomplished poet and a Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. His latest collection is called Unaccompanied, and it chronicles his memories of El Salvador, his journey through the Sonoran Desert, and the difficulty of settling in a new land.
To President-elect. There's no fence. There's a tunnel. There's a hole in the wall. Yes. You think right now no one's running? Then who is it that sweats and shits their shit there for the cactus? We craved water. Our piss turned the brightest yellow. I am not the only 9-year-old who has slipped my backpack under the rancher's fences. I'm still in that van that picked us up from Devil's Highway. The white van honked 3 times, honks heard by German shepherds, helicopters, migra trucks. I don't know where the drybacks are who ran with dogs chasing after them. Correction, I do know. At night, they return to say, sobreviviste, bicho. Sobreviviste, carnal. Yes, we overlived. My name is Javier Zamora. I was born in El Salvador and I immigrated here when I was 9. My dad must have been 18 in 1990 when I was born, and at the same time, he was part of a co-op in my town that was predominantly run by the right-wing government. There was a lot of soldiers there. And so he got into debt, some trouble, some political trouble, so he was afraid. So then he came to the United States. And my mom, because we were still, even though my dad was sending money, she couldn't find a job as a woman at that time, post-war. I waited for them to gather enough money for them to send for me. And then eventually, 5 years after, they had enough money, and then I made my trip up here, which was supposed to take 2 weeks with the person that they paid. But then that person left me and a group of 6 others from El Salvador in Mexico. And then we had to figure our way up through Mexico through the Sonoran Desert and eventually to the United States. It took me 3 tries to cross the Sonoran Desert. And that part of the journey took around 2 weeks. Those are the hardest poems to write, and it took me a long time to edit because of the trauma. That's perhaps the most traumatic experience of my life, being so close to death and being rounded up like cattle almost by immigration officers and being in jail, being a kid, immigrating. When I did as a 9-year-old, I could still see the beauty in the nature around me because I wasn't so aware of the dangers. You know, there was a gang member who helped me come to this country, and I wouldn't be here without him. This young man, he was 18 when I was 9. He loved me. You know, he fed me. He provided shelter. He talked to me. He was like an older brother, and I wouldn't be here, you know, without him. I still don't know his real name. I only knew him as Chino. Second attempt crossing for Chino. In the middle of that desert that didn't look like sand and sand only, in the middle of those acacias, whiptails, and coyotes, someone yelled, "La Migra," and everyone ran. In that dried creek where 40 of us slept, we turned to each other, and you flew from my side in the dirt. Black-throated sparrows and dawn hitting the tops of mezquites. Against the herd of legs, you sprinted back toward me. I jumped on your shoulders, and we ran from the white trucks, then their guns. I said, "Freeze, Chino. Para, por favor." So I wouldn't touch their legs that kicked you. You pushed me under your chest, and I've never thanked you. Beautiful Chino. The only name I know to call you by. Farewell, your tattooed chest, the M, the S, the 13. Farewell, the phone number you gave me when you went east to Virginia and I went west to San Francisco. You called twice a month. Then your cousin said the gang you ran from in San Salvador found you in Alexandria. Farewell, your brown arms that shielded me then, that shield me now, from La Migra. I think what's missing in the media and the way journalism covers the immigration, especially immigration from El Salvador, I think it's the humanity of individuals like gang members. You're either a complete criminal or you're a straight-A student. And most of us are in the middle. You may think that I am a good immigrant, that this is what could happen when the quote-unquote American dream is satisfied. I don't feel like I'm in no f***ing dream. And it was important for me to include poems where I say that I'm literally f***ed up, where I'm drinking, where there's a lot of despair, because I think those are the realities that even dreamers, quote unquote, and good valedictorian people, like immigrants who want green cards, go through. People don't realize in this country, and even in El Salvador, we fail to call what's happening in my country a war, when statistically there are more people dying now in peacetime than there were during the Civil War. Yeah. You know, my trip was bad, but I can't imagine immigrating now with the cartels and even all the gang violence and the cartel violence and having to take a train through Mexico. You know, all of that I did not experience. I experienced differently, but not like that. Yeah, like it is harder to immigrate now, and there are more people immigrating now. I think we inherently learn to keep some things private, because I can guarantee that the kids that make it here by themselves successfully, they had to evade police and they had to keep quiet multiple times like I did. You know, I had to lie, I had to pretend that I was Mexican so I wouldn't get deported back to El Salvador or Guatemala. So these are all these things that get tied to you, and counseling helps, you know, unlearning all those things that helped you survive but are not healthy in the regular world. The very first poem that I wrote, knowing that it was a poem, was called Mi Tierra, My Land, which addressed, you know, what I had left. And I had never had that medium for me to release all that pent-up anger and angst and longing. And I liked it. I kept on going back to the page. I wrote other works. And then eventually I was writing about my immigration story because I didn't see those stories in paper as poetry. I kept on looking for immigrant work. I think this would have helped me heal a lot. And so, yeah, that's who the book is for. Any Central American immigrant who has crossed the border and has lived something similar. Refugee. Tu abuelita Nelly. This is my 14th time pressing roses in fake passports. For each year, I haven't climbed Marañón trees. I'm sorry I've lied about where I was born. Today, this country chose its first black president. Maybe he changes things. I've told mom I don't want to have to choose to get married. You understand. Abuelita, I can't go back and return. There's no path to papers. I've got nothing left but dreams where I'm the parakeet nest on the flor de fuego, the paper boats we made when streets flooded, or toys I buried by the foxtail ferns. Do you know the ferns I mean? The ones we planted the first birthday without my parents. I'll never be a citizen. I'll never scrub clothes with pumice stones over the big cement tub under the almond trees. Last time you called, you said, my old friends think that now I'm from some town between this bay and our estero, and that I'm a coconut, brown on the outside, white inside. Abuelita, please forgive me, but tell them they don't know shit.
That was Javier Zamora reading from his newest collection of poetry called Unaccompanied. That piece was produced by Hannah Kingsley Ma. You can see him reading this week live at Alley Cat Bookstore, that's tomorrow, and at Lit Crawl this weekend. More details about both of these readings at our website, kalw.org. Click Crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we're going to hear from another poet who will be reading at Saturday's Lit Crawl event for Copper Canyon Press. Poet and professor Dean Rader's latest collection is called Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry. It examines how we construct our own identities every day using pop culture, politics, and literature. And he isn't afraid to make a wide range of references in his work, from the internet to expressionist art. He spoke with KALW's Jen Cheehan about where he draws inspiration for his poetry, and he starts with one of his poems.
So this is a poem for my wife, composed partially in the manner of Chris and Desiree from The Bachelorette. Each season of ours is a secret, like a code our son invents when he pretends to be a spy. No one, not even us, knows how or when we think of the other. If there were magic glasses to see you better, I would not wear them. I like to imagine the distant unknown of you in your life of offices, meetings, and cool jeans. I wear a trench coat and search for the clues in the abandoned warehouse of a heart. I hope is mine. I love you the way a producer loves an audience he sees once a week through a man and a woman on a set, which is to say, eagerly, and not without some strange self-interest. Every day, without knowing it, you look into the camera and ask, "Will I accept this rose?" And I always say, "Yes."
Thank you. It's very sweet.
It's pretty sweet.
It ends up being sweet.
Yes.
So I'd like to talk about where inspiration comes from for you. This poem that you just read references reality TV. Elsewhere, you reference Langston Hughes, Paul Klee, Frog and Toad, and Wikipedia, of course. Do you think about distinctions like highbrow or lowbrow?
I think the distinctions between the two are real, but pointless in some ways. I think people are afraid they're going to get poems wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's this kind of poetry angst out there, and people see a poem, they're like, oh, I'm just not going to understand that poem, or I'm just going to get that wrong. And if there is one thing you can do, like have the word bachelorette in the title, immediately that relieves some anxiety. Like, oh, I know the bachelorette. Maybe I'll like this poem. So I am interested in this book demystifying poetry in some ways. Someone who knows about the bachelorette or Paul Klee might find some entry into the book. They might see those things as invitations in, that not all poetry is exclusive or high culture or effete or eliminating in some strange way. So I want the book to be an invitation in. And one way I think to do that is to have poems that already put the reader and me on the same page.
You talked about an invitation into poetry. What was your own invitation in? What made you fall in love with poetry? What or who?
I still remember it. So I was an undergraduate, and I was just assigned in this random literature class to read some poems in this poetry anthology, Modern American Poets. And I remember I was sitting in the cafeteria, and I remember turning to this one page, and there were W.S. Merwin poems on the left and James Wright poems on the right. And reading these poems and feeling like the room was moving away from me. I had no idea that there was poetry in the world out there like this. And it took me to some other realm. I still remember it like it was yesterday. And I remember thinking, wow, if this is out there, and it's considered poetry, and I didn't know about it, what else is out there? And then not long after that was the next level. Can I write something that maybe one day would make someone feel the way these poems made me feel?
Well, the name of the new collection, Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry, is actually the name of a poem that you wrote. And then the form of that poem was exactly what it sounds like, with citations and hyperlinks that you could actually click.
Exactly.
Some surreal and kind of weird and funny facts, biographical facts about you. So what led you to name this new collection after that particular poem?
After my first book of poems came out, someone did a Wikipedia page for me. But about half the information was incorrect.
Do you know who it was?
No,
or it just
no clue. It just appeared. Based on some things in it, I could probably hazard a guess. But a lot of the things were not quite right. I mean, some were more or less right, but others were not right. And I thought how interesting it would be if all someone knew about you were accurate and inaccurate details in a Wikipedia entry. And then I thought about how interesting it would be if in a Wikipedia entry were not sort of public verifiable things, but private things like what you're afraid of or what you think about God. And so when I was thinking about this notion of self-portraiture, I thought, oh, in this digital age what we know about someone tends to be what we can find online, and these kind of verifiable but yet not wholly verifiable and not comprehensive or accurate renderings, just random data that's out there. So I thought I would have some fun with the idea of Dean Rader. So the poem is full of actual facts, flat-out lies, and made-up stuff. So I'm very interested in the assemblage of the self and the assemblage of culture. And I think we are all interested in a range of things. And we might love comic books and TV shows and art and fine food and wine. And so what makes us who we are, how we assemble ourselves in terms of ideas, texts, language, I think that we seek information in a lot of different ways. And so the publication of the book is about my interest in what's knowable or not about the self, about the world, about language, about identity, those kinds of things.
Those kinds of small things.
The tiny things, right.
That was poet Dean Rader speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. The piece was produced by Jackie Sajiko. You can see Dean improvising new poetry with Copper Canyon Poets at a performance called Tell No One, a Kind of Poetry Telephone. That's on Saturday, and it's going to be at Craftsman and Wolves in San Francisco, part of Lit Crawl. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Bava.